When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
If you are a child of the 1980s, you love theme parks, and you live in a world of dark and surreal fiction, then you will no doubt have visited Mockery Manor. You might remember your parents waxing lyrical about how excited they were back in the 1950s when they first heard the news that a new theme park was coming.
A beautiful stately home, devastated by fire in 48. To be reborn like a phoenix from the ashes in 58 as Mockery Manor Family Amusement Park. Once a place of bucolic tranquility, now home to four timeless lands packed with wonderful experiences. As you pass through the main gate, you enter the village, where it's always 1647. Oh dear, has Mother been fingered as a witch? It's the ducking stool for her. After such humble beginnings, grab a parasol and stroll into Fancyland, a place of opulence and splendor, where little boys and girls can ride in fast and fancy carriages. And what could be more fitting for a little lord and lady than our next stop, Empire Land? An exotic place based on the Mockery family's involvement with the East India Company. Watch out for those tigers. That's not a tiger. And finally, Dreamland, a land where dreams come true. As Carl Jung would say, dreams are a door to the soul. And at Mockery Manor, our doors are wide open.
Of course, there were some teething troubles. But then came the grand reopening in the 1980s.
There is a house deep in the woods where the sound of screaming fills the air.
This summer, come on down to Mockery Manor Amusement Park for the grand reopening. Spend a fun-filled family day out with furry feline mascots Queen Boo Boos.
Yeah.
And her hapless page boy, Mr. Crackles.
Trousers, meowsies.
There's something for everyone at Mockery Manor, for you crazy kids. For Mum, Dad, Granny and Grandpa.
Ooh, a bar. Pint of sherry, please.
And let's not forget those ghastly teens. This year, Halloween starts extra early. Every Saturday, the park opens late for Mockery Manor's Spooky Nights.
Spooky Nights.
It'll scare the pants off you.
Stop it, Terry.
Oh.
Mockery Manor, where childhood never dies. It just goes on and on.
Mockery Manor is an immersive, full-cast audio fiction podcast created by Lindsay Sharman and Lawrence Owen of Long Cat Media. Part of a stable of shows which also includes the wickedly irreverent improvised comedy based around the psychic entertainer Madame Magenta. Season 1 of Mockery Manor launched back in 2019 and quickly became recognised for its high production values, top-class script and dark humour. This year has seen the launch of Season 2, which takes some of the characters from the original overseas to the German theme park of Dunkelschloss, where theming is very much centred around folk and fairy tales.
Come and make some memories in a
a magical world of fun. Eurobear's waiting to welcome you home to Dunkle 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 Schloss.
Discover a magical land of fairy tales in the heart of the Black Forest. Hear the little mermaids lament on the seafoam rapids. Spin gold into fun on Rumpelstiltskin's golden ferris wheel. And head on down to Baba Yaga's Chicken Hut for the best fried chicken in Germany.
Yee-haw!
Call 0702 611 452 for your free planning video.
Come and give Eurobear a great big hug at Dunkle 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 Schloss.
And new for 92. Don't miss the Trousers Meowsers Mega Coaster.
And that's where we come in. As an enthusiastic listener of Mockery Manor, I wanted to grab the chance to invite Lindsay and Lawrence onto the Folklore Podcast to take the opportunity to discuss the modern take of folk tales and storytelling which Mockery Manor adopts. This is, after all, storytelling for the 21st century, but drawing upon some older and well-established folk tales and characters. Here then is my interview with Long Cat Media, interspersed with some more audio and songs from Season 2 of Mockery Manor along the way. We hope you enjoy your visit. So Lindsay and Lawrence from Long Cat Media, welcome onto the Folklore Podcast. It's nice to have you here.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Oh, the pleasure is all mine. Now, we are going to talk about a number of things to do with using folklore creatively. With creativity. I can get my words out correctly. So rather than looking at the folklore itself, which is what we often concentrate on these episodes, we'll do a bit of that. But we will explore the ways in which it informs you as creators and how you work with the subject. So I know you do various things, but primarily we will focus on Mockery Manor for the majority of this interview. So let's first explain what Mockery Manor is for those that are not familiar with that particular podcast, and a little bit about yourselves as creators too.
Okay, so well, Mockery Manor is a mystery thriller fiction podcast series that is set in a theme park in 1980s Britain in season one. And then for season two, we move to another theme park, which is in the Black Forest. And that is, we're into the 90s at that point.
Some people describe it as a comedy, and it does have a very strong comedic edge. But I think that's just our sensibilities sort of leaking through rather than it being a straightforward sort of sitcom-ish thing.
Yeah, I don't think you really set out to write a comedy, did you?
Not really, but I entertain myself with jokes and things. And so a lot of people would describe it as a comedy.
Yes. I can see where you're coming from with that, certainly. I mean, there is a certain amount of dark humour to it, but I think anybody who can create a restaurant such as Baba Yaga's Fried Chicken Hut probably is using a bit of comedy in there as well.
What? No, it's very serious.
It's extremely serious. I don't know what you're implying.
And in the first season, we have Gunga Dindins as well.
Oh, yeah.
We were quite proud of that one.
That was my favourite from season one, I must say.
Gunga Dindins. Yeah, why do we always come up with the joke restaurant names first? Was it Unidentified Frying Objects is another one.
Oh, yeah, the UFO diner. Mm. Yeah, yeah. Very proud of that, too. What is it about puns that they're so awful and yet you feel so proud when you come up with
I wonder if that is anything to do with sort of American roadside culture, because you get a lot of eateries in the kind of the Route 66 tradition with pun names. And I wonder if we've sort of absorbed that a little bit,
yeah,
particularly in when it's, you know, in the world of something like theme parks.
Yes, you could well be right. I think that probably has a lot to do with it. So tell us a little bit about the inception of Mockery Manor, and particularly, I suppose, going into season two, where you focus on Dunkle Schloss, the Black Forest theme park, where you're drawing a lot more heavily on kind of folkloric aspects.
So I think the inception of Mockery Manor was partly because of our love of theme parks.
Mm.
So we're a bit sad in that respect.
I don't think we should describe ourselves. But no, Lindsay is correct.
But we are critical of them as well. So we're not just sort of, we're not in love with them blindly. We are kind of like intrigued by various aspects of theme parks, both American and European.
Yeah, we've certainly spent a lot of time in Disney parks around the world, as well as some of the weirder British theme parks. And I think I've always been interested in particularly, and I've always felt that theme parks, when done well, are some of the best sort of immersive storytelling that you can find. I think when it's executed well, it's just an extraordinary thing.
And there's such a mishmash as well. You know, they draw on so many different things, so many different sort of ideas and areas of the world, and all shoved together in this sort of strange fake land.
Yeah.
And for storytelling purposes, that's really rich.
It's very exciting from an audio point of view, because I am also a composer. So I write the music for the productions that we make. And from my point of view, that's a very exciting thing to be in a theme park, because, as Lindsay says, you can sort of crash between very, very different worlds very quickly by going from different sort of land to different land. And that gives me a lot of scope to make fun music, and it gives Lindsay a lot of scope to write some ridiculous settings for drama to happen in.
And there's something about the juxtapositions that's inherently kind of horrific and inherently comedic as well.
Mm.
So it's just it's such an interesting backdrop for horrible things to happen and for amusing things to happen as well. Like so, for instance, in the first season of Mockery Manor, there's an area of the park that is really colonial. It's got a Heart of Darkness log flume ride and the aforementioned Gunga Dindins. And that's because in every theme park, you see something that harkens to some sort of like the grand, the wonderful age of colonialism. You know,
yeah.
It's completely non-critical in all these theme parks. It's always sort of like men in pith helmets, and it's always held up to be a fun, great thing. Explorers, ha-ha!
Yeah.
And that nowadays is really interesting to look at, because it's obviously, the idea of it is actually rooted in this terrible history.
Mm.
And yet it's been flattened and made into this fun thing for children.
Mm. One of the oldest Disney rides is the Jungle Cruise, which they have sort of recently updated to remove the sort of, you know, in inverted commas, natives and things
yes.
like that.
Yes.
But they still kind of haven't gone completely all the way. There's a lot of aspects of what we take of as being, we think of as being kind of beloved classic theme park attractions that are pretty questionable.
Yeah,
still.
Really dark. So we've just taken that another step. And
yeah.
I think with season two of Mockery, which is set in Dunkelschloss, we've done that with the fairy tales as well.
Yes.
So it's taking these stories which are rooted in sort of pain and suffering and weird. They're so weird, the original fairy tales. And then they were put through a Disney filter and all of that weirdness and horror was taken out or flattened. And then we've sort of put it back again. Because the idea of that being a fun place for children, and yet there being all this strange subtext, is really both horrific and amusing, I guess.
Yeah, so I would argue that not all theme park rides are a fun place for children for various reasons. You know, I mean, there are rides like The Mummy, which are, you know, aimed at older children, certainly. But even rides that are aimed at younger children, I mean, defy anybody to go through Small World more than once.
We have many times.
We're very familiar with Small World, but we even acknowledge that in our own parody of Small World.
Yeah, well, I dug into the first time I went on Small World, and I just couldn't believe what a weird acid trip the whole thing was. But you'd Lawrence had already been on Small World by that point several times, and I was like, why didn't you warn me?
I couldn't warn her. Lindsay about it. You have to go in completely cold.
Yeah.
Oh yes, it's no fun if you've been pre-warned.
Yeah, exactly.
And then subsequent trips around it though, you get used to the horror. You get used to how weird it is, and it's a bit of a shame because you miss that initial impact of how peculiar the whole thing is. So I wanted to put that peculiarity into our fictitious theme parks.
And certainly there's something that's very enjoyable about taking sort of properties and stories that have been very famously adapted by Disney, and then sort of trying to imagine what a fictitious ride that is based on the original story might look like.
We are the elves of Europe, compatriots are we, united by the magic of hands across the sea. The world was once a single island. What better way to live than that? We are the elves of Europe, a ring of golden stars. No friction at our borders, no tariffs on our cars. So join with us, your elven seedlings, and sing a song of peace and cheer. There are elves in every city, every village, every town, every forest, field and toadstool. There's an elf that wants to be found. We are all the elves of Europe, and we all must play our part in the trading block of adventure. We have Europe in our hearts.
I mean, you talk about immersive storytelling here, which is obviously what you get in any theme park attraction. When you're working purely in the audio realm, it becomes a slightly different beast, doesn't it?
Well, actually, in a weird way, because audio fiction is so intimate, and it's almost like a weird in-between land between novels, film, and TV. As in, because like in a novel, you're imagining everything, and so you're kind of like intimately placed into it. And with film and TV, though, it's you know, you're listening to characters and you're following their adventures, but not with the sort of prose that you get in a novel. So it's a kind of like a hybrid. So you can actually borrow some of the intimacy of a novel and some of the kind of like epicness of film and TV and smoosh them together. And so it can be quite immersive, I think.
Yeah, and sound on its own is surprisingly evocative. It's interesting. I've always thought, I think back to the early days of YouTube, this is relevant. and in the very early days of YouTube, you had really terrible video quality. It was, you know, 480p, really fuzzy. Everything looked terrible. But the sound was sort of comparatively a bit better. And somehow that was fine. And now we wouldn't want to go back to that, obviously. But I remember thinking in the early days of YouTube, yeah, it looks rubbish, but it sounds fine. And that's actually all you need. Your brain
true.
Will do a lot of the work, you know, for you.
Yeah, and you can create things using audio alone that you could never create visually on the kind of budgets that you're working with.
Certainly. Yeah. I mean, we if we were to try and make a visual version of Mockery Manor, be it on stage or screen,
it'd
cost an absolute fortune. It'd be impossible. And we wouldn't be able to satisfy all of the weird whims that we'll come up with. Like, you'll suddenly decide that there'll be an enormous mountain in one section of the park.
Yeah.
But that mountain might appear in one scene and never feature again. That would be a very expensive set.
Yeah, yeah.
If we were talking about film or TV.
And we've made some high-end theme parks here. Like Mockery Manor, actually, there's nothing like it in the UK, especially in 1989 when this is set. You know, we've got we've gone above and beyond like Disney levels of theming, I think, haven't we?
Yeah,
because
I mean,
we can, because it doesn't cost anything.
Yeah.
Yes, I mean, certainly there's a roller coaster that we have in season one, which is sort of space themed, the Roswell crash coaster, which is starts off with a sort of dark ride through an alien autopsy, and then takes them off, basically blasts them into space, and it's a sort of an indoor roller coaster after that. But yeah, the budget required to build a ride like that would have been a huge, huge challenge even for the likes of Disney, certainly in the 80s. So the idea that some regional theme park in the UK would be able to build a ride like that is in itself a fairy tale. But it's fun, and it's the whole thing is a fantasy, really. So we can do that sort of thing.
But they've got the backing of Wizard Entertainment behind them, who have all the money, of course.
They do. Wizard Entertainment, the global conglomerate, multinational,
yeah, shady.
Very shady organisation.
So, Lindsay, you decided with season two to draw a lot more heavily on kind of aspects of folklore when you moved across to the Black Forest for the setting for a lot of that season, which is still playing out at the moment. Why did you choose to do that?
Well, I think we'd explored a lot about the peculiarities of British theme parks in the first season, but we hadn't really actually gone into the fairy tale element of, like, the Disney parks, for instance. But actually not just the Disney parks, but there's Efteling in Holland, which is very fairy tale themed.
Yes, I mean, we would say, I'd say that Dunkelschloss, which is the name of the theme park in season two, is something of a cross between European theme parks like, yeah, Efteling in the Netherlands, which is a very old family-run theme park, which has been operational since the pre-Disneyland days, early 50s. Mm. And they have really kept a quite strange, dark fairy tale aesthetic that's not actually a million miles away from what we're doing, but this is like the real version. Mm. And it's a lot more eccentric than anything you would find in sort of perhaps more famous theme parks. So it's a cross between that and Europa Park, which is a real theme park that genuinely is in the Black Forest, which is a sort of showcase of Europe.
But also is kind of like a weird testing ground for a lot of Disney rides.
Yeah, there's a company that manufacture rides that sort of actually own the park. Normally rides are you know, made by companies and then bought by the people running the theme park. But the company that builds rides actually operates Europa Park, so you can get some quite strange rides there that are being sort of almost tested.
Yeah, and some of the systems do end up in Disney.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that has... But also, you'd be forgiven for thinking it was ripping off Disney because it's got versions of Disney rides in there, hasn't it? And it's got a version of the Epcot golf ball as well.
Yeah.
And it's quite overt, really, the sort of the shades of Disney in there.
Mm-hmm. So we thought we would use some of the sort of weirder European aspects of theme parkery to tell these famous folk stories in a different way to what we, you know, would expect to see in the likes of a Disney park.
Yeah, because in Mockery Manor season one, when we were inventing the park, we were sort of looking at the zones that you get in a Disney park. And we didn't use all of those zones. So, for instance, like I said, there's that colonial kind of like Adventureland element. And then there's the Magic Kingdom in Disney, which is the fairy tale place. But we kind of stripped it of the fairy tale stuff and just had the sort of strange like royal family elements to it. The sort of, you know, princes and princesses. But what if they were part of the British royal family? So we have like...
Was it Prince Philip's Carousel?
Yeah, Prince Philip's Carousel, the real Prince Philip, and the Tipsy Tea Room, which is the Queen Mum's kind of like gin tea room.
Yes.
But we hadn't really explored the Magic Kingdom fairy tale element, so that's what we wanted to do in season two.
And it seemed like the Black Forest was a good place
to
put a park like that, somewhere really rooted in
German
mystery.
And because in season one as well, Mockery Manor is surrounded by forest, which is just instantly creepy, really, isn't it? And isolates the teens in this place, so it makes it more threatening. So we wanted another park that was surrounded by forest.
So you're able then to draw on some of the darker aspects of folklore, and you start the second season with a warning from a lorry driver in the forest against being... caught by Der Grossmann.
Ha! Now then, this is a nice quiet spot.
Why are we stopping?
End of the road for you, kiddo.
What do you mean? There's nothing here. It's just road and forest.
Aye. The Black Forest. Beautiful, isn't it? A canopy so thick it turns day to night. They say it's haunted, you know.
Haunted?
By the spirits of those who lost their way. Summoned forth by the forest witches. Even the devil himself has been seen dancing between the trees. And of course, there's Der Grossmann.
Der Grossmann?
The tall man. He roams the forest, looking for naughty children who have strayed from their mother's side.
Right, out you get then.
Oh!
Go on, jump down. I haven't got all day.
Okay.
it's interesting. Like we don't claim to be experts on any of these things, so we're sort of in ourselves absorbing folklore from kind of Wikipedia and distant knowledge. So it's an interesting experience to kind of be writing with sort of half knowledge as in the same sort of way that it's like a kind of modern version of oral tradition.
Yeah, because we're a product of Disney films we watched as kids, weird fairy tale books that we got as kids and that stuck with us. So Baba Yaga, I had a fairy tale book with Baba Yaga in and the bony legs, and that stayed with me for will stay with me forever. And also, yeah, Googling. So there's not a lot of academic research that went into this.
But De Grossman, that is, isn't he the origin of the Slender Man?
Well, the two are connected. Yes, right. The two are connected. So the tall man, De Grossman, is depicted in an alleged 16th century woodcut. But the only available original source for this 16th century woodcut is the Something Awful Forum, which is the same forum where Slender Man was created.
How interesting.
So it is essentially, so De Grossman is essentially a parallel creepypasta that draws on the Slender Man image but places it in a German 16th century setting, and it kind of appears to have developed in exactly the same way as Slender Man did, where all of a sudden, after not very much time at all, people start getting confused as to whether this is a genuine piece of old supernatural lore or not. And we saw this with Slender Man, where very quickly a lot of the fan creations became embedded and people became very confused about whether it was a modern construct or not. And this is kind of like an offshoot of that, I guess.
So is De Grossman, in fact, a much more modern creation? You know, so this 16th century woodcut, is that a totally fictitious woodcut?
As far as we can ascertain, yes.
Ah, interesting. Because I was looking up the Black Forest fairy tales, but also some of the festival. They have a festival in, I can't remember, sort of April, May sort of time, filled with people in sort of devilish-looking outfits. But I couldn't find much in English about this festival. But I was kind of thinking, oh, it's a real shame that I can't that I've chosen a different time period for when the season is happening, because I would quite like this creepy festival at the same time.
Oh, because we're in the summer, aren't we?
Yeah. But De Grossman, I think there's an idea that, you know, there's people on stilts and things like that wearing creepy outfits.
Yeah.
So I think that maybe the De Grossman is also extrapolated from that. I'm not entirely sure.
I mean, I feel like it's a sort of recurring. I mean, certainly in these Russian folk stories that we've starting to touch on as well, this idea of a kind of very skinny person who roams to prey on unsuspecting travellers.
Oh, yeah, and people are always being, like, children and wives and mothers are always being kidnapped, aren't they? And so yes. De Grossman, I think the idea with him is he kidnaps children who aren't being obedient.
Right.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Sounds like a lot of them.
Yeah, I mean, that's typical of a lot of fairy tales, isn't it? Where the underlying thing is, you know, obey your parents, children.
Yeah.
But also has a kind of horror element to it as well.
Yes, this is something that we were thinking about, like the original context of what we now think of as fairy tales for children that have since been softened into Disney films and so on, is that probably a lot of them were written as horror stories.
Yeah, to incur a kind of visceral thrill.
And so the you were saying earlier, Lindsay, that the genre has sort of just changed.
Yeah.
The genre of storytelling has changed.
This is purely a theory that I've got. But I was just thinking about what it would have been like to receive a story like that, 200, 300 years ago.
Yeah, it would be like seeing a horror film in the cinema.
Yeah. And your oral storyteller, depending on their skills and everything, could easily scare the pants off of you, I imagine.
Or make it really funny.
Yeah.
If they get it wrong.
Yeah. Or a combination of the two, which is exactly what we're trying to do.
Yeah.
So as far as De Grossman goes, there is an alleged account from 1702, which translated into English that tells the story, which is kind of what you're drawing on here, I guess. And it runs like this. This is the alleged translation. My child, my lass, he is gone, taken from his bed. The only thing that we found was a scrap of black clothing. It feels like cotton, but it's softer, thicker. Lars came into my bedroom yesterday, screaming at the top of his lungs that the angel is outside. I asked him what he was talking about, and he told me some nonsense fairy story about Der Grossmann. He said he went into the groves by our village and found one of my cows dead, hanging from a tree. I thought nothing of it at first, but now he is gone. We must find Lars, and my family must leave before we are killed. I am sorry, my son. I should have listened. May God forgive me.
Ooh, that's good, isn't it?
That's very good.
When's that from?
That is a supposed translated account from 1702.
Right.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? Because child abduction, I think, is one of everyone's primal fears.
Oh, yeah.
And you see it so much in fiction nowadays as well, and it's just reoccurs time and time again down oral history.
It's funny, I find in the reaction that I'm having to sort of hearing that, and which may have been written in 1701 or may have been written in 2004, I almost don't mind. I like it regardless, and if it wants to insert itself into the sort of lexicon of,
well, yes, which is exactly what's happened, really. So the relation to Slender Man, this is drawing from the Slender Man Connection wiki page, for example, which goes on to say, Der Grossmann is a creepypasta written by a something awful user named Toro Up about a mythical monster from 16th century Germany implied to be the Slender Man. Although most fans believe the story is a genuine myth, there is no proof of that claim being true, because the only sites where information on the creature can be found are all Slender Man related.
Yeah, that's what I had when I was Googling it. That's exactly what was happening to me. I was going, is this real? Is this not? Oh, it's too good not to use. So
that's it. Yeah, but if you can't find a source from anywhere outside of the mythos, the chances are that it is created as part of that mythos. But that doesn't make it any less valid in the kind of context that you're using it, does it?
Yeah, well, the lorry driver himself is purely trying to freak the main character, JJ, out. And so so he's not going to be going, oh, I'm not entirely sure if this is a story that originates in the Black Forest. He's just going to say whatever he wants
to. So maybe that lorry driver is in fact the user on the Slender Man forum some years later.
Maybe. Or maybe that, he's just typical of oral storytellers where they're like, oh, well, this is very effective. This makes the audience really react. So let's just tweak a few elements of it, make it a bit creepier and see what happens.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. That's how these stories develop and stick around, isn't it? So what else appealed to you? What else have you drawn on as this season unfolds?
So we've got different zones in Dunkelschloss. One of them is this kind of Slavic zone. So we have Koshai the Deathless, and we have the Whispering Trees, which tell different Slavic folktales if you press your ear against the trunk. And it also has a stage in this area, where it has the Dunkelschloss Battle of the Bands, because we think metal is quite an Eastern European thing as
well. Yes, so at the time of this being recorded, the episode with the Dunkelschloss Battle of the Bands has not yet come out, so that's a treat for the future. I'm very much enjoying exploring these stories in a metal context as well. from a music point of view, that this is why this sort of thing is a lot of fun, because one episode I can be writing, you know, a scratchy old shellac record from the 1930s, and then next week I'll be doing a sort of Scandinavian metal tune or something.
And the high drama and weirdness of the Slavic folktales really lends itself to this genre of music,
this
I think.
Operatic prog metal.
Yes, I shall look forward to listening to that episode.
Yeah. And of course, in that zone is also Baba Yaga's fried chicken hut.
Yeah. Koshai the Deathless is a really interesting character. It's sort of like, it seems to me to be very similar to what turned into Horcruxes in the Harry Potter world. This sort of idea of somebody splitting their soul into different sort of...
He's very Voldemort, isn't he?
Yeah, different vessels. And then, again, this is another character who's depicted as a very thin, frightening person.
Yeah, a thin old man, I think.
I bet this is based on just more paranoia about death and mortality, and as a lot of horror films are.
And again, Koshai seemed to be someone who liked stealing people's wives, mothers, children.
Yeah,
they can never get their own, can they?
The paranoia is quite clear in these stories, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's certainly a theme you find in a lot, isn't it? But as you were saying, you know, stories are used for warnings. They're used for warnings against, you know, being immoral, against, you know, not doing things that are dangerous, all sorts of things. So that's just what you're drawing out, really, isn't it?
Yeah. The Slavic folktales are particularly peculiar, I think. You can really sense the sort of, a people who are suffering, I think.
Yeah.
But also have retained a sense of humour. There was one that I wanted to use, but I didn't in the end, which was about a 7-inch man who had a 7-foot beard. I think that was the way round it went.
Yeah, it was. It was, yeah.
Yeah, and he was incredibly angry, and people were supposed to be scared of him. But I was like, how could he catch you? He's 7 inches.
I mean, he would just
high.
Look like a snake, wouldn't he? He'd just be like a long trailing object on the floor.
Yeah, you could stand on his beard, and that'd be him out of action.
I can't see that he'd be much of a threat.
And I couldn't think of what kind of ride experience we could attach to this strange
well, yeah,
little man.
Because he's sort of too small. The only thing he could be in is like a model village or something.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. You could sell him in the gift shop.
All right, yeah.
Too
maybe,
much hair,
yeah, maybe we'll sell like troll-like characters.
We might do that.
You know.
Yeah. So, what are the other zones? So we also
we have Rumpelstiltskin's Carnival Land.
Oh yes, yeah. So we've gone for because carnivals are also places that are considered quite creepy as well.
So we have the Rumpelstiltskin's Golden Ferris Wheel.
Yeah, and various sort of carnival esque. Stalls.
What's the hook a duck thing? Oh no, it's a.
So there's hook an ugly duckling, but there's also toss the frisbee over the firstborn.
Yeah.
In order to win the firstborn, just a sort of doll.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we've got Hans Christian Island.
Yes.
So that's got the Little Mermaid's Lament, which is a whitewater rafting experience.
The Seafoam Rapids.
The Seafoam Rapids, that's it. And sort of. And a cave thing as well. What do you call it?
It's like a cave system, like a maze.
Yeah, yeah, although I haven't really figured that one out yet.
It's not like... We're definitely not making this up as we go along.
No. We always start... We always plan it out beforehand, but then when it gets to the episodes itself, they get a lot more fleshed out. But yeah, they might be a little thin... When in the early stages when we're planning,
we do know where it's going. We'd like to assure listeners that we have worked out the story.
Yeah.
How far ahead do you write out of interest? I mean, once you've done all the background research before you launch too far into this, I guess from what you're saying. But then how far ahead do you work?
So I know how it's going to end, but I've always found with me and planning that there's no point planning more than about 3 episodes ahead, because if I do, I go off-piste at some point anyway and I have to change the plan. So yeah, I'm always about 3 episodes ahead.
Yes, and you like we know the kind of, yeah, the sort of main beats of the story.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I know the arc of all the characters, but I don't necessarily know the minutiae because I leave that up to when I'm writing it, because it's just more interesting for me, and it's just it stops you from boxing yourself into a corner as well.
And I think one of the joys of being an independent podcast company is because we are sort of recording these things as we go along, we don't record all of them in one go and then release them sort of week by week, which is certainly another way of doing it.
Yeah, we can't really afford to do that, really, to be honest.
But one of the nice things about doing it that way is that we can respond to what the actors bring, and we can decide to, you know, play with certain things a bit more. If an actor surprises us, we can incorporate something that, you know, might have been a more minor aspect of it before we knew that was something that they had in them, if that makes sense.
Yes, because of course you brought in Alistair Beckett-King as a voice actor in the second season, and
yes.
Those that listen to folklore-related podcasts will recognise Alistair as being one half of the Lawmen,
correct?
A very, very good podcast, which which covers some very interesting aspects of folklore, just in a very silly way.
Oh, yeah.
And I imagine that Alistair probably has quite a lot to bring to the table from that kind of folklore comedy aspect as well.
He hasn't really discussed that kind of thing with us. He's he has just arrived for us as a voice actor in those sessions and just delivered what's on the page pretty much. But he's so funny. I mean, we've known Alistair for quite a few years now because we were on the comedy circuit. And one of the reasons why we chose Alistair for this season was actually because he could do loads of different accents, which makes him a lot cheaper.
Yes.
Because it means, sorry to keep
I mean, that's not the only reason we...
Yeah, oh no, he's brilliant, obviously. But it does really help because obviously if you can pay one actor to do several characters, then that's a lot cheaper than paying a lot of separate actors. And he wouldn't mind us saying this because we all work on a shoestring on the comedy circuit.
Yes.
We're always finding ways to do these things. And we knew as well he could absolutely deliver the comedy.
Most rooms are still like that. Very old, very neglected.
Yeah. What's the story here?
The story? Well, once upon a time, they started renovating the Schloss, hoping to make it into a fancy hotel for high-paying guests. But the Schloss proved more broken than they originally thought. Every repair demanded 1,000 more. Rot lurked in the walls and floors. The old Schloss was greedy. It gobbled up hundreds of thousands of Deutschmarks, and it wanted more, millions more. So they were forced to stop. Years passed, and one day a young girl took up residence in the broken castle, and she...
Oh, don't... Those fairy tales don't tend to end well, do they?
Yes, do not accept any gifts from frightening older women. That's my advice.
Gotcha. No apples or spinning wheels.
He's a prolifically talented guy and also a great kind of master of pastiche himself. His own videos that he releases are just spectacularly well-observed takedowns of famous TV shows or recognisable tropes in video games and so on. He's just got an incredible eye for not only spotting the comedy and the quirks of these genres, but also being able to sort of perfectly execute them from just within his flat. It's remarkable.
Yes,
really.
they really have, and he gets a ridiculous number of views for them as
yes,
well.
and rightly so, because they're great.
Absolutely.
And he looks like someone from mythology.
He does.
Well.
He. I remember, I hope this is not revealing an opening gag of his, but I remember the first time we saw him perform, he would walk onto the stage and say, "I know what you're thinking, I look like a stained glass window depicting the execution of John the Baptist." And it's just so accurate.
And then he'd grab his own hair and sort of hang his head in a ghoulish fashion. And it was incredible. It was such a good impression. It instantly looked like
he didn't really need to do anything else after that point. The audience were just totally on board.
Yeah.
You are, as you say, independent podcasters, and based on the discussion of the last couple of minutes, maybe before we move on, this is just a good time for you to say how people can support you and what you're doing.
Well, yeah, you can find all of our projects on our website, which is longcatmedia.com. You can also follow us at Longcat Media on all of the socials. If you want to follow Mockery Manor specifically, you can find at Mockery Manor on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram as well. We also have another series that we made called The Ballad of Anne and Mary, which is a five-part musical swashbuckling adventure about the pirates Anne Bonny and Mary Read. And also Magenta. Do you want to explain who Magenta is?
Oh, yes.
Yes.
So, Magenta. We have about 70 episodes of Madame Magenta, and she is a psychic and medium who is drunk about 50% of the time, and her husband Bernard, her long-suffering husband, played by Lawrence. I've written a couple of books in the character of Magenta. So it's kind of like an audiobook where she keeps breaking off to chat to Bernard, her husband. So it's as read by Magenta.
The author.
The author, Magenta. It's, yeah, that's not a very good explanation, is it? I've really mangled that.
I think that was actually very magenta, what you just did. But she'll also receive letters from listeners who, and she'll use the powers of the occult to solve their problems.
Yeah, she's a sort of mixture of a complete fraud and accidentally, occasionally, genuinely magical.
Yeah.
And do you draw on any of those kind of aspects of psychic belief or the occult or people that do profess to be mediums in the construction of this character? Or is this purely a kind of excuse for an improvisational free-for-all, if you like?
Oh, no, I do draw on these things. I think, like a lot of teenage girls, I was kind of into tarot and runes, but in a slightly embarrassed way because I realised it was probably all nonsense. So I did spend, some guilty years leafing through tarot books.
I have certainly occasionally walked in to find you checking tarot readings.
And then I'm like, I don't believe it. I know it's not real. Yeah, it's like I'm looking at porn.
Yeah, you quickly flash up some porn onto your screen to cover
it's
the tarot.
It's fine, it's only porn.
Yeah.
It's interesting, isn't it, though? Because that is working very much on the aspects of superstition which are around people every day. You know, you don't believe that there's anything to superstition, but you still won't walk under a ladder.
Yeah.
Or, you know, you need to salute a magpie if you see one, even though you're perhaps not even sure really why you're doing it. You just know that you should.
I don't know if it's a generational thing, but I can't step on drains that have three covers. Three drains. I don't know if there's anyone listening. Yeah, three drains. I don't know if this is a thing that maybe was unique to like my childhood in London in the 90s, but if you stepped on a drain that had three covers, that was bad luck, and you had to undo it by stepping on a drain that had two covers. Like odd numbers were bad, even numbers were good. That was the.
I think that's the strange kind of flash of OCD a lot of us sort of have within us, I think.
Yeah, but it definitely wasn't just me. I would see people avoiding three drains.
Oh, right.
Now,
yeah.
You say that, yeah. I can point you to a very, very good essay, believe it or not, on the folklore of manhole covers. Which covers this exact thing, different types of drain cover and the superstition attached to them. It's not as bizarre as it sounds.
I'm delighted that you have that for us. That's exactly why we come on these podcasts.
I mean, I suppose the idea of an unknown entity rearing up from underneath. I mean, you have that on the loo as well, don't you?
Oh yeah, something's going to crawl up.
Yeah, yeah. The certainty that at some point it's only a matter of time before a snake or a rat or some sort of sewer crocodile rears up out of your toilets.
Yeah, and some of that does stem from the urban myths surrounding sewer crocodiles and sort of the ridiculously sized alligators and that sort of thing. But then sometimes you might just live in Australia.
Well, that's it. I mean, I was thinking, as we were saying that, there are probably certain countries in the world and certain points in history where it would be a genuine...
Yeah.
A genuine concern that you would have to very carefully check.
Well, you're very vulnerable when you go to the loo, aren't you?
Yeah,
I have colleagues in Australia who have posted far too many pictures of things that they've found in toilets that just you would never go again.
Right. I just chucked a crab out of the toilet.
It's horrendous, it really is. Do you think that this being a kind of folklore, fairy tale, those kinds of aspects, is something that you will continue to draw on as something that stimulates creativity through storytelling?
Oh, definitely. I think there's no way of getting away from it. I suppose in a very fundamental way as well, it reflects our fears, our paranoias, sort of the essentials of being a human, sort of fear of death and fear of sickness and fear of loss.
Yeah, it's like all of the big, really important things, often through a lens that is really quite silly and confusing because of the years that have elapsed since these traditions first appeared, and probably the sort of things that would, you know, to people in the Black Forest in the 16th century, they might go, oh yes, yes, that's very understandable, it makes a lot of sense, to us would now seem ridiculous. Or maybe it was always ridiculous, and that's kind of part of the fun of it.
Well, I think
really
we're
knowing.
Used to metaphor, though, aren't we? Mm. It's part of how we understand things. And I think it's also part of how we absorb things without feeling the horror of it too much.
Yeah.
So it's a lot easier to talk about something like loss if it's through a bogeyman than relating it directly to your own losses, perhaps.
And we do seem to be drawn quite a lot to a sort of horror genre or a kind of fantasy-ish genre of writing. We're definitely not in the sort of literary realm. We are in sort of genre fiction in our tastes. And so that will intertwine with folklore and tradition quite a lot, I would have thought.
There's quite a lot of literary takes on folktales, though. It's actually because of the sort of slightly, the metaphorical nature of it, all the symbolism. It's actually used quite a lot in literary fiction.
Yeah, true.
But we've, I think, gone more for the drunk oral storyteller who's playing up the more ridiculous elements of it, perhaps.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So looking into a certain psychic's crystal ball for just a moment, then, what does the future hold for Long Cat? You're obviously working on the rest of season two of Mockery at the moment. Where do you think you're going to go from there?
So there's going to be another season of Magenta.
Yes, so, that's the next thing after that.
Yeah. And actually, we've... can we talk about Fable and Folly? I suppose we can.
I think we can probably.
Yeah, we've just gone on the network of Fable and Folly, and so we'll be doing some crossovers with some of their podcasts, some of which are very folktale-y.
Yes, right. We won't reveal who we're going to be collaborating with, but similar sort of feel for sure. And as is a lot of the output of Fable and Folly Network, that we definitely feel like we're a good fit for them. So yeah, we're very happy to be joining them.
Yeah.
We're going to keep making Mockery, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's so much fun.
It's such a rich world.
And we can keep inventing theme parks and building bits in the original parks.
Yeah, it's just wish fulfillment, really, isn't
it? Yeah, pretty much. It's pretty much a video game that we're playing in audio drama form.
Yeah. It's just as much as for us as it is for any listeners, really.
Yeah.
Although, just to go back as a final point on something that you said earlier on about, you know, the joy of working in audio and being able to do anything that you couldn't do on the stage, you did, of course, recently perform season one, episodes one and two of Mockery on the stage.
Yeah, that was great fun.
It was really fun. We never thought we would ever do it. It was never intended to be done on stage, but...
It does make the murders a bit harder. Because when a murder happens in your ear holes, you can imagine it. But when it's happening in front of you and the person has a microphone in their face, and they go... It's less horrific and more comedy, which is fine.
I was surprised by how sort of few exceptions needed to be made. Like we didn't. It felt very natural.
We didn't do it like a play. We did it like a performed radio play.
Yeah. So there were some things that were not sort of that were played for laughs that aren't played for laughs in the actual series, because we sort of felt like, for the reasons that Lindsay's just described, we didn't really have a choice but to do it that way. But actually, it just made it into a slightly different thing. It was like a live version, a live show based on the series.
It was really nice to get live audience feedback as well.
Yeah.
Because obviously, the way we put things out, we know the audience is out there, we see the download figures, and we have some interaction on social media with our audience, but it feels kind of weirdly ephemeral.
Yeah.
Whereas having an actual audience in front of you where you can see the whites of their eyes, that's really nice. You have a kind of energy exchange.
And it is kind of good to be there in the room and go, oh yeah, I thought that was funny.
Yeah,
and people did laugh, so that's good. That's a relief.
Really, all you've done is come full circle, isn't it? From drawing on a tradition of oral storytelling, where people are gathered around, listening to one person telling a tale, to then translating it into audio with a remote audience, and you've just come back to the original way of telling stories again.
I suppose so. Yeah.
Yeah.
And we met doing live stand-up comedy. That's how we met each other. So in a way, we've come full circle in another way there.
Maybe we're not even coming full circle. Maybe we've just always been there.
Oh my God.
Rotating.
Just orbiting.
Well, I shall look forward to whatever comes out of Long Cat's stable in the future, as much as I have been enjoying listening to Mockery thus far. Thank you both so much for coming on and taking the time to chat about it.
Our pleasure.
Thank you very much for having us. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks to Lindsay and Lawrence for coming on to discuss Mockery Manor, which I really recommend you seek out and enjoy if you haven't listened before. Here's a final montage to whet your appetites.
A theme park can be a very dangerous place.
Longcat Media presents...
If there's one thing I've learned, it's this. They're all lying, cheating bastards.
A British Podcast Award nominee.
That was my worst nightmare. I can't believe you didn't tell me it was a drop ride.
It's so much better when you don't know.
The black comedy that Stephen Fry called remarkably immersive.
Something's happening in the park. Something dangerous.
She is dead meat, her and her stupid sister.
Who am I, Jenkins?
I think something terrible's happened, but I don't know what.
Do you know what would happen if Mockery Manor closed?
Please, we have to get out of here.
Hold on to your hats and glasses and pray to your god.
Mockery Manor.
I made a spirograph once with string.
Good for you.
Seasons 1 and 2 of Mockery Manor, available now wherever you get podcasts.
In a moment, we'll close with another piece of Lawrence's music from the show, but first, just a reminder that the Folklore Podcast is part of the Folklore Network, endeavouring to collect and preserve folklore in all of its forms across all mediums for the future. All of our main output is completely free to access and enjoy, but we do need your help to keep up our vital work. Any contribution you make will directly support both the Folklore Podcast and the Folklore Library and Archive, an ever-expanding repository for folklore books, documents and recordings for future generations of researchers. If you can, please join our Patreon at www.patreon.com/thefolklorepodcast or visit our website at www.thefolklorepodcast.com where you can find more information as well as making a one-off donation if you want to. Whatever else you can do, please do share our content and tell others about our work. Thank you. Now, here to close from Mockery Manor Season 2 is The Mermaid's Lament.
Thank you.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.